Today's podcast is brought to you by Cypress International, a premier consultancy company providing business development, M&A, and cybersecurity services to its clients as they navigate in the dynamic national security portfolio. This podcast series will focus on what the Navy needs from industry to make tomorrow's carrier wing more effectively support the warfighter in the evolving distributed maritime operations environment. This podcast is the second of a two-part series and includes insights and commentary from Scott Swift, Admiral, U.S. Navy retired, a Cypress subject matter expert and the former commander, U.S. Pacific Fleet, as well as Bruce Lindsay, Vice Admiral, U.S. Navy retired, a Cypress subject matter expert and former deputy commander, U.S. Fleet Forces Command, and will be moderated by Jim McCarthy, Cypress Vice President, Naval Programs, and former Assistant Deputy Chief of Naval Operations, Capabilities, and Resources.
It needs to set guideposts in the future, and that's how I view the 60-40 split. He's got to get moving in that direction. And so I'm not speaking for the CNO, but I don't think those are hard and fast numbers, but he's got to set a post that drives a large organization intellectually and strategically into that space. So I think that this debate that continues is reflective of how inclusive and expansive the Navy is being and considering what the near term and the future might be, recognizing that those two things are connected. You know, what can you leverage off of F-18 and what is it going to be in the future? How do you maintain it if you stick with what you have, or how do you grow it? And I think the biggest type model series that drives that discussion is Growler. That's critical capability. And there's a lot of uncertainty about how much of that can be unmanned. You know, when you look at readiness degraders, a lot of it is the pod. So trying to digitize that capability and getting it out there, that has value to the total force. Same thing with F-35. We're learning a lot about F-35. There's people that are critical of the cost, the readiness cost of it. But when you look at the things that Admiral Weitzel's talking about, live, virtual, constructive, we may be in a different world 5 years from now of, you know, talking about this manned, unmanned piece and the split. How much hands-on training, actual training in the cockpit is necessary? That's heresy as an aviator to say that. But I feel a little bit on firmer ground saying that as an aviator. You know, it's as Admiral Gortney says, it's altitude under ass and, you know, whatever the heck it was. You know, but his point is you got to be in the cockpit. You got to be on the bridge. You know, you've got to be experiencing those things. But we may be transitioning in a little bit different world that maybe the old model of assessing readiness is a little bit different going forward. The other thing I'll say about it, F-35, is the mission set that it executes is huge. So the training aspect is going to be higher and costs are going to be higher as a result. So when we talk about cost per flight hour, you need to take a look at the breakdown. If you can do more missions with that airplane than you can with F-18s or other legacy platforms, there's a return on investment there. So it can't be just a cost discussion. And I think that flows into the NGAD and the MQ-25. The MQ-25 makes perfect sense to me. You know, rather than taking an older platform and unmanning it, we've got to make sure, and I think this is what one of the CNO's focus is, Navy's focus is we got to be building bridges and not barriers. So the MQ-25 can do a lot more. It's a bridge into the future, but it's high risk to say we're going to send that thing into combat. Take the airframe, the ability to operate it day, night off a carrier flight deck, that is a huge challenge. Yeah, we did some experimentation to prove that we could do it and the risk was acceptable, but to fly it into combat mixed in with manned aircraft, boy, that is real high risk. We need to, as I said before, we need to take a measured approach to this. But by the same token of building bridges, which I see the MQ-25 as helping now current, freeing up F-18s that we know can fight in that forward environment, and making sure in that process that we're either breaking down barriers and certainly not creating barriers. And I see the MQ-25 as covering down on both of those, building bridges without building barriers.
That's a quote right there, not so. That build bridges, not barriers, as you experiment going forward. That's right in the CNO's wheelhouse. I think that would resonate very nicely.
Yeah, So that was a great skit. Actually, we're answering question number five already, but the issue on autonomous operations in combat, I think that there is some, it's worthy to spend some time sort of talking about, you know, we've all had these unmanned discussions. We don't have any autonomous systems right now. We don't have any. We have a lot of expert systems. We tell it what to do. It does exactly what we told it to do. It doesn't think. It doesn't reason. It doesn't learn from its mistakes. Autonomy does. So in order to bring an unmanned system into combat, it has to be autonomous, because the pilot can't focus on what's out, you know, on his HUD, and at the same time worry about driving the thing next to him. And having it, you know, just be a loyal wingman and follow him around really isn't adding value. So, you know, you have to have the autonomy, and then you have to trust the autonomy, which is a big hurdle. Trusting that when it shoots, it's going to shoot at the right thing and not the wrong thing. You know, just convincing yourself there's never going to be a blue on blue from an autonomous vehicle. If you get into the furball, you want to make sure that you're absolutely certain that's true, because you don't want your own wingman shooting you down, right? So you think that's worth having that discussion in this question five here? So what are your thoughts?
I think that you're right. And I know Notso has written his part on the AI and trust. All I would say is to gain trust with AI, and I agree, first you get the autonomy first, but there's a trust in the autonomy that it doesn't run into something or kill somebody like cars that we're looking at here. So an autonomous vehicle, we have to approach this like industry is doing with the cars, and also with our networks, which is zero trust approaches. However, you must understand that you never gain zero trust. You can't do that. We are humans, and we don't have 100% trust. So we can't have 100% zero trust in our approaches. So I think experimenting under numerous conditions is the way to do it. Think of Elon Musk and landing the rocket body on that platform at sea. He failed multiple times, but finally got it. So we're going to have to continue to take systems, automate those systems, and then just like we do when we trust our pilot, we gave them a whole lot of reps and sets. So we got to get this system reps and sets in representative environments, and then you're going to have to continue to move it out into the contested airspace. Not so?
Yeah, so Jim, I think that this is exactly right. I think it's an excellent question. And I don't want to be too scripted. I don't want to think that we're going to flow exactly the way we are, but it's almost, and there's a lot of administrative back and forth as we're thinking through that, you know, won't be there in the podcast. But if the podcast goes 60% the way this is going, it's going to be a huge success. I'm not in the mindset now that, geez, we got to get 30% better for success. These are great, great questions. So here's my response to this issue of trust, and that is that your AI comment, the way you frame the question in the context of your own thinking is powerful. It makes it much easier for us. We don't have to use time then to characterize it. I think Bertie's comments are spot on. Hey, so here's what my response is. First of all, I'm not the expert on AI, but there are, I recognize experts when I see them. So I'm going to call her out here. I hope she's not offended by it. And that's Katarina McFarland. She's a fellow consultant with Cypress. I have learned more from her in this world of AI. You know, she was, and I'll get the term right, not counselor, but commissioners on the AI study that was sponsored by Congress and co-hosted by Bob Work, and I forget the Google CEO now, but I'll get that down. Another pitch for Cypress is what I'm driving at. But this idea of trust, Jim, you brought up the fact we got to make sure that our wingman's not going to shoot us down, and we know that's really important because we've done it on two regular bases in the past. You know, I can remember a pilot. Rendezvous, an inexperienced Navy pilot and two-seat aircraft rendezvousing on a tanker, and there were F-4s that were playing Red Air that were on the tanker in front of, you know, the Navy aircraft followed the Red Air, and the Red Air went to the tanker, and the pilot in the front seat said to the radar operator in the back seat, the NFO in the back seat, "What should I do?" And the guy in the back seat said nonchalantly, "Shoot him down." And so the F-4 came off the tanker, and the pilot fired a sidewinder at him and shot the damn airplane down. So this idea of trust, to what level? We are already painting AI with this brush that, oh my God, ROE's going out the window. Who's going to be responsible for the failures that are bound to occur? First of all, my personal view is I think the chance of failure is much reduced in an AI world because it's measurable. It's ones and zeros. It's not making subjective decisions. It's making objective decisions. In this period of discovery, we need to think more broadly. I would advise people to review the AI study that was conducted that Katerina was a part of, because I think we're being too constrained in our thinking. We need to be more expansive. Now, when it comes to implementation, I'm back to MQ-25. We're not just going unmanned straight out and suddenly we're going to replace, you know, the fighter and attack aircraft that we have in the air wing, but we're going to take a measured approach to it. I think we should make a measured approach to AI. My personal view is we're moving too slowly. We need to move faster.
This one is, you know, really about, you know, where do we need industry's help in bringing the costs of these things down? Particularly, you know, when you do things like automation in an aircraft, you know, there's this belief that, well, the airplane will be cheaper. No, it'll be more expensive. You're trying to put a pilot in a computer and all the things that a pilot does, and that takes computing power that's expensive. So these systems, the expectation of these systems are going to be cheaper, I think, is short-sighted. I think they're going to be more expensive, which means we've got to be more circumspect about what are they going to do, how are they going to do it, how many do I need, and what can industry do to help us bring that cost down, or at least control that cost so that, you know, quantity and quantity having a capability all of its own kind of thing doesn't get in the way of doing the mission set. So I think probably I'd start with you, Natsu.
Yeah, so first of all, I think that the way you framed the question with a statement of what your own beliefs are is powerful. I think that's helpful in focusing the discussion and pointing out the kind of dialogue that happens on a daily basis within the Cypress ecosystem. But costs are going to increase. I mean, they're just going to get more expensive. We're getting more efficient and more effective, but the environment that we're competing in is getting much more complicated, and that's going to drive cost. The other point that you bring up and I think you are making that statement is useful, is to say that I agree that unmanned doesn't make things cheaper. When you take a look at the systems that you no longer have to build into a airframe, when you take the man out of it, the oxygen systems, pressurization systems, displays, and the rest of it, that's not, you know, that there's still computing power in there. There's still flight computers. You know, there's got to be self-contained capacity to make decisions to fly the airplane and what, not just fly the airplane, but to operate the airplane. And then when you look at the footprint, you know, the Air Force has been in this space for a long time with MQ-9, and it's amazing the strides that General Atomics has made of decreasing that footprint. But this concept of cost, that bringing down the cost per flight hour, I think we need to look at it differently. I think that we have legacy thinking with respect to what's required to ensure the relevancy of the data, to ensure the redundancy of failover systems. I go back to the Ford class shock trials test. You know, is that really required? You know, I get that we crash cars because we're not spending the same level on a car to ensure its crashworthiness. You know, when I look at the requirements for the windshield on a fighter aircraft, you know, we were shooting frozen turkeys at those things at 400 miles an hour, you know, and that's because the risk associated with a frozen turkey at 40,000 feet was sufficiently that people in decision points felt that we need to take it out to those extreme points to test to. We have to think that's how we have to drive cost down. So this cost equation is, it's not just government, it's industry as well. And I'll close on this point before I turn it back to you. And that is, I have the terminology wrong because I've looked for it in the Air Force. But in talking with industry, the Air Force has this concept of data banks, that they create a data bank, and as long the transition in and out of that bank, it gets to the application of apps. As long as your system is compatible with that bank, it reduces the test requirement. And it helps us, that concept is something that we need to embrace across DOD. It's the Apple example. It infuriates me that I got to pay $1,200 to Apple for the hardware that allows them access to all my data, which is where they get all the profit. I mean, they're double dipping here. They should be giving me iPhones. It's the same approach that the military takes. We're so stuck on these legacy concepts of data. We've got to work together with industry to accept and test industry best practices. And we need to drive industry to the fact that they need to understand that even though they get a profit margin out of what I would describe as some of these arcane approaches, it's in the best interest of everybody to drive these cost of ownership down. Because as long as that cost of ownership is high, it's going to be hard to get at that pillar of capacity, of the numbers of assets required. Because numbers have a quality all of their own. That equation hasn't changed. So this is something that we need to team with to drive cost down.
Now, there's another aspect of this, not so before I turn it over to Bertie, that I'd like you to comment on. So I take the pilot out, I take the ejection seats out, I take the air system, the pressurization. So the weight comes down, which means in my mind, I can get longer sorties out of it. Is, you know, can you drive the sortie rate to the point where the cost equation changes? Because now I'm not having to launch 2 and 3 aircraft into the same sortie.
I absolutely think that you can. The one thing that I'm unsure of that's connected to this is attrition rates. So you have to have sufficient attrition in your inventory to cover down on what those rates are. So it's not a binary approach. If you take the human out of the airframe system, you suddenly have a huge increase in both range, because you've reduced the cost, and also the time associated with range. You know, I flew a 7-hour mission in OIF in the early days. I got to tell you, I was not the same pilot in the first 2 hours that I was in the last 2 hours. That's not true of unmanned. That airframe delivers the same capacity and capability in the last 4 hours that it did in the first 4 hours. So that has to be, it's not this binary approach that we see too often from pundits that are saying, oh, it's unaffordable. You've got to look at the total cost of ownership. On the range piece, if you decrease the weight, you can also increase the ordnance and the fuel. And I think that's fungible. And especially if it's refuelable. I'm not, you know, when we're talking about laser weapons and all the rest of, you know, the laser itself as a weapon, I'm not sure that it's not rearmable airborne in a context. There's all kinds of ideas that right now you would think that is crazy. And then you start to think about it and saying, we're already at the leading edge that we can do those kinds of things. And I think unmanned takes us intellectually into that space where if we're stuck on this idea, oh no, we can't get rid of unmanned, that limits our intellectual thinking, just having that concept itself. We need to be much more intellectually inquisitive about what the near term and the future might be. This is our strength as Americans. This is our strength as a democracy. this is a strength that our peer competitors out there don't have economically, environmentally, governmentally, war fighting, all those elements. So I think your question is spot on.
Elon Musk said it costs a lot to, you know, build new rockets. If I could just save the rocket body. And he went along this path, which everybody thought was crazy. And now he's landing rocket bodies and reusing them and driving the cost down. That's that innovation that Natso just talked about. I will have to say, though, technology in most all other sectors leads to lower cost in constant dollars. For example, the real price of a new car fell by 10% from 1998 to 2006. I just pulled that out. And one would say there are more safety features. There's more technology in there. I try to buy a new car every 4 years because if I don't, I'm going to be an 80-year-old and I won't even be able to know how to turn the thing on. So there are sectors that can drive costs down or keep them constant in constant in constant dollars. So I would say industry must adapt current technologies and innovate newer technologies to reduce the total operating costs. We have to do that or we'll drive ourselves out of business there. JSF is an example, and it gets Congress's attention. Representative Smith is all over Joint Strike Fighter because of that cost equation. And then you lose the idea that Natso just talked about JSF today and JSF tomorrow, and then how that really will get us that advantage in the high-end fight. So we just have to drive those costs down, and technology can do that. The other part is thinking bigger. We don't see bigger budgets coming. The U.S. debt to GDP ratio is rapidly rising, and pretty soon our economy will not be able to provide the defense sector the appropriate resources. So it's in our best interest, both of us, as Natso said, industry and the government, to contain costs, control costs. Now, cost per flight hour, that's a legacy way of thinking about it. I think Natso brought this up. It's cost per flight hour per capability. So if you have a JSF, that has a lot more capability than, say, just an F-18 straight stick, maybe. So we have to be more nuanced in the way that we talk about cost. And that's where I kind of stop. You know, I'd add maybe one other thing. We just can't blame the acquisition process. That's not going to get us anywhere. And we already see that the Deputy Secretary of the Navy, Hondo Gertz, has really been innovative in trying to change the way we acquire programs. So I think that effort needs to continue to go on. So it's both acquisition, industry, and the Navy working hand in hand as partners to drive this cost equation to constant dollars.
Jim, I think Bertie's point is spot on, especially that last point about pulling Hondo's, what he has done in his most recent career, previous in the SECNAV staff and now as the under. So I think the more that we can include those folks that we know and both positive, you know, critique them in either positive, you know, honest ways, not necessarily positive and negative is good. And then I think your point on cost is spot on. I'm just saying that I don't see those costs changing significantly. But the point being is that debate within the Cyprus ecosystem provides value to the clients. And that may be something you want to consider as the moderator to say, there are no black, and we'd have computers answering these questions. This is the value that Cyprus gets out of our staff and our consultants. So I think that's good.
So when you talked about integrated deterrence that the Secretary of Defense has recently put out when he was at the Indo-PACOM change of command, it makes me think right about distributed maritime operations, the three attributes. And the first one is integrated, and we talk about that. That is important. And of course, that means when you're distributed across the large expanses of the ocean, you must be working as one. And so if one senses, another can shoot and the other can decide. So we're taking all of this and distributing across, making it harder for the enemy and imposing cost in time and distance to them because we're integrated. So I think it's very important that Secretary of Defense talked about that at the big eye, as you said, the whole of government, and then that feeds into the little eye, which is the attribute of integrated and distributed maritime operations. I will say that what we need to do is be able to find, fix, and finish at scale and quicker. And we're going to have to do this through our own command and control networks. And each service is going to do that. Each service has a little bit different attributes, 70% common maybe, but there's 30% that we do that they don't do. That's why we have the different services. So I don't think you're going to have one network forced on everybody. What you're going to have is multiple networks that are interoperable and integrated. And to do that, you have to have data standards and open architecture. And this is actually good, because if you have redundancy in your networks, because you have different networks, okay, then you can continue to fight if one network comes down. Again, they all, though, have to be integrated. The attribute of redundancy requires AI. It needs AI to monitor the networks for health and intrusion, and it needs AI, more importantly, to route the information to the correct person in the find, fix, finish at scale and at speed. So when you think about the commonalities, I think about commonalities and capability, JSF, A, B, and C, but commonality also necessary for integration of the effects, both kinetic as in fires and non-kinetic as in cyber. So the buzz phrase should be AI for what effect, and the effect must be integratable across the joint force. So I'll just stop right there, because I do have another piece and I didn't know how to work it in there, but it's about think about each service is operating their own cloud for C2, but the clouds are all integrated because they all have the same data standards and based on open architecture. You could go one step further and say that they all employ the same operating system so that we don't waste time translating between Microsoft Word and Mac Pages. So if you had various clouds, one operating system, then any application you develop, okay, think about DevSec ops and pushing software changes. One could go from one cloud to the other and back, and at the speed of 5G, and this creates that redundancy and clouds, a plethora of apps that can the enemy cannot break into them all, and simultaneously, and it gets to decision dominance, which is where the Navy wants to go. So now bring it back into the carrier air wing of the future. You're seeing that with the first part with JSF. And then as we bring in the Naval Tactical Grid that is integrated into JADC2, then you're seeing the power of all the sum of all the individual things are greater than the sum. So I think that's how we're going to get after it. Not so.
Yeah. So let me answer the question in a part A and a part B. Part B will be very short. So part A is a focus on DoD. And I think Secretary Austin's comments at INDOPACOM's change of command was not a watershed event, as some people have characterized it. I think it was more of an inflection point. It was a statement of, in his mind, where DoD is now. With respect to the competitions that we face globally, and what's the near-term path forward? It was his first opportunity, the first major opportunity that he took to frame the thinking within DoD and those that have interest in DoD. So I think we talked about interdependence in the past. That always made me nervous, because that created a vulnerability. I felt that if you were dependent upon somebody else to provide something to make you whole, if that other individual or entity couldn't provide that, you aren't efficient or effective. We then transitioned to interoperability. I think interoperability remains very important, but it's insufficient. And I think the two words, integrated deterrence, the focus there is on integrated, that we absolutely have to be integrated. It's more than just jointness. And I'll give you some examples that I'm going to back into. The first is that I had the benefit of participating in an AUSA panel that was Army focused about how the Army should think about the Pacific, but it was a great discussion. I got an awful lot out of it, and I certainly appreciate General Brown's invitation to invite, oh, by the way, another Cyprus consultant. And in that, I made the comment that in the past, I've talked about the importance of being platform agnostic and system agnostic. That was quoted in the press, but it left out the context of it, that it's in reference to weapons, that we need weapons that are system agnostic, platform agnostic, and I've added data agnostic, which goes to Bertie's comments about protocols and design attributes of data to make sure data is as interoperable as it can be, as integrated as it can be, regardless of the source of that data. And so now what that takes you into this integrated deterrence, it's in support of access to all service weapons. And I'll use the example of something like an SM-6 or a torpedo, which historically have been viewed as naval weapons. Well, an SM-6 has relevancy to the Marine Corps. And we see it in the context of the Marines' EAB context. It also has relevancy to the Air Force. So if I can shoot an SM-6 off a JSTARS or an AWACS data feed, hey, that's huge. It reduces my sensor requirement. It reduces that sensor field. This falls right into the concept of maritime domain operations. This is what I think the secretary was driving at. Maybe not in the forefront of his mind, but certainly broadly on his mind about how we should think. And then let me throw one out there that I don't quite understand myself, but I think it's important to be at the leading edge of thinking innovatively, and that's torpedoes. Well, why can't we target torpedoes through other systems, that not just the systems that are indigenous, that are directly connected with the submarine? We do it with P-8s and helos, but we need to expand it much beyond that. And I think that's what the secretary's driving at. The other point I would make before I move on to point B is the importance of thinking, the importance of the thinking strategically, planning operation, acting tactically. We also operate at a strategic level at the same time we operate at an operational level, at the same time we operate at a tactical level. And we need to stop categorizing data as strategic, operational, tactical. Data is data. And I go what to Lieutenant General Smith, CD&I in the Marine Corps, and his comment about cloudlets, that he wants his Marines at the squad level to have access to critical information. And if that information is branded as strategic, it's going to be difficult to get to them. So this is, I think, what General Austin was talking about. To those that are listening that are confused by JADC2, welcome to my world. But that's okay, because JADC2, this is its, and we're looking to get the answer out of JADC2. It goes back to this comment that we started off with: why do we need JADC2? How do we incorporate it? And what is it going to do to us? This is what Cyprus does. So it's okay if there's uncertainty here. Where there's uncertainty and instability, there's opportunity. You know, that's a byline that I see at play every day in Cyprus. So that's my pitch on JADC2. The last thing that I can't resist, because of all the other things that I do commenting on, is something that Secretary Austin has both spoken about and he's taken action on. And that is this integrated deterrence. This integrated deterrence comes from a whole of government approach. He's mentioned the importance of a whole of nation approach. If you look at China as a competitor, they have a whole of government approach, easier to do in a communist government. They have a whole of nation approach, easy to do when you control all the media. So this is not just a DOD piece. This is a cabinet level, Congress level effort, this integrated deterrence of a whole of nation approach as well. But that's beyond the scope of this podcast. So, Jim, I'll turn it back over to you.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate your time. Your insights have been incredibly valuable, both to me and sure our client base, and the understanding where the carrier aviation of the future is going to go, and you know what's going to be important and what is a viable future path for investment for industry is going to be very, very helpful to all of our clients. So with that, I'd like to turn this over and get any final comments you've got before we finish up this podcast. Admiral Lindsay, over you first, please.
Jim, it's been a pleasure to be here with you and Admiral Swift. Admiral Swift, one of the greatest thinkers we've ever had in our Navy. I think about his quote about the tactical edge, and it reminds me that all those lieutenants in naval aviation are at the tactical edge. They're out on aircraft carriers, and they have the ideas for the future of naval aviation. I think those mid-grades, those majors and lieutenant commanders, I think they've been around just long enough so that they can have that ingenuity that we require to take those ideas and probably put them together in ways that us older folks just could not have thought of. And when you get that, I think you're gonna get the capability increases you need. And then if industry listens, and the service chiefs listen to our young lieutenants and mid-grade officers, I think naval aviation will be in a very good place. Again, it's been a pleasure to be here today with you.
Thank you, Admiral Lindsay. Admiral Swift?
It has been a great discussion, which I hope that I've given as much as I've taken. It's been very worthwhile for me. But let me close on this point. Now is not the time to narrow our perspective, which I think is what Admiral Lindsay was talking about. Interesting, he ran from the bottom up and not the top down, talking about lieutenants and what they're thinking from the perspective of their challenges out there. And I know the same is true of Marine captains and the work that General Berger and his leadership team is doing and pulling their insights as to how to get after the EABO concept and expeditionary basing. You know, I made a comment in the past when I was in uniform about how critical it was to relevancy in the Indo-Pacific to be as expeditionary and mobile as possible. So there are some tenets that I think are still true and that we should make sure are part of our thinking. They shouldn't necessarily consume our thinking, but they should be part of our thinking. I use hypersonics as an example. Each one of these issues is a double-edged sword. Hypersonics has been used as an example of how vulnerable U.S. forces are, regardless of service, our Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and now Coast Guard, that Coast Guard is playing a more consequential role in the Pacific. So I think it's very important that practitioners, those in uniform, those that support them, certainly industry and Congress, needs to maintain a broad perspective. And if people are looking for a specific answer for a specific solution, I think they're going to be disappointed. That's not what I see from the service chiefs. I think they're keeping a broad perspective on the challenges that we see as China's a peer competitor. I mentioned the Black Sea operations earlier. We're not diminishing the challenges created by Russia and others. But I hope that discussions like this, and I know I enjoy my work with Cyprus, that ensures that spectrum is broad. You know, Jim, you spent an awful lot of time on the bridges of cruisers. You know, I don't know how much that time was looking over the bowsprit. You know, you spent a lot of time on the bridge wings, looking astern and to the sides, to see where the threats are. And I think that mindset is baked into certainly those that I get to work with, like Admiral Lindsay, as well as the core staff there at Cyprus. So thanks once again for this opportunity.
This podcast was made possible by Cyprus International. Please visit us online at www.cyprusintl.com.